Hi, I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about integrity in sports. In recent years, almost every sport has been compromised by some sort of scandal. It could be gambling, could be doping, it could be sexual misconduct, it could be just plain cheating. Whatever it is, it tarnishes the sport. We will talk today about whether things are better or worse in the world of sport than they were in years past. We will discuss this with our guests, Julie Rowe Lash of the NCAA, longtime sports writer Bill Benner, author Daniel Lee, and former IRS Commissioner Mark Everson, who oversaw the Balco steroid scandal. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join the conversation. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about integrity in sports, and we're fortunate to have as our guests Julie Rowe Lash, who is the Vice President of Enforcement for the NCAA. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Appreciate the opportunity. Good to have you here. Bill Benner, longtime Indianapolis sports writer, now with the Horizon League. Bill, welcome to the program.
Absolutely. Delighted to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Lee, who is the author of the new book, The Belgian Hammer, about aspiring young U.S. cyclists. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we will be joined fairly soon by Mark Everson, who is a former IRS commissioner who oversaw the Balco steroid scandal. I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to start here first just by talking, make sure we're all talking about the same thing. When we talk about integrity in sports, what do we mean by that? And Julie, I think I'll start with you. When something compromises the integrity of the game, what does that mean to you?
Sure, and integrity is such a bedrock principle, I think, for so many, but especially for college athletics. And it's oftentimes when I hear people define integrity, you hear terms like honesty, courage to do the right thing, even when it may be unpopular. My basketball coach from college actually used to define integrity by doing the right thing when no one's watching, but then she'd follow it up with, and when no one will find out. And when we look at college sports and what undermines integrity, it really goes to what undermines the values of the game. So competitive equity, fairness, accountability, any action that threatens one of those core principles also acts to undermine integrity.
Daniel Lee, how do you define integrity in sports?
To me, it's actually quite simple. Is for fans watching a sporting event or for athletes participating, that it is a true, authentic competition. It's not fraudulent. It's not prescripted. No one has an unfair advantage other than what they could get through their own training or strategy. And for athletes, that means at the end of the game or the race or whatever it might be, that they can know that they won or lost on their own tactics, merits, good or bad luck. Fans can know that, you know, again, they can feel inspired without feeling that they may be being duped in the process. You know, looking back on some of the things we all know about in sports we felt so good about, that now we feel a little naive for even enjoying the moment. And, you know, when you watch an event you know has integrity, you can feel good about it, feel like a kid again. And athletes can either celebrate or really have, you know, be disappointed knowing that they gave their all, you know, and that the event played out as it did. That's the great thing about sports, is it's supposed to be unscripted.
Bill Benner, how do you do it? You've covered sports and been around the sports world for probably longer than either of us would care to acknowledge. Bill and I used to work together at the Star on the News.
Yep.
So, how do you define integrity in sports as a longtime observer?
Yeah, I would echo what Julie and Dan both said. I mean, I think it's doing things the right way. And we all know what that is. We all should know what that is. It's so easy to take shortcuts. And too many times, because of outside pressures and sometimes internal pressures, it's easy to succumb to those shortcuts and try to take the easy way and find a way around doing acting with comportment and integrity. And But I will tell you, my perceptions began to change late in my daily sports writing career, and it actually began to change with a conversation that I had with Julie mm-hmm. not long before the 2000 men's Final Four here in Indianapolis, where she I decided to take a look at the enforcement process at the NCAA. Because it's so easy to criticize the NCAA. They're such a lovely whipping boy.
And we'll give Julie a chance to talk about what it's like to be a pinata for her.
But as Julie really helped me in understand the enforcement process, the self-reporting that goes on, and now that I work for the Horizon League, I will tell you that my appreciation for those who are doing it the right way, acting with integrity, acting with honesty, not trying to unlevel the playing field, are far more in the majority, but it's not the thing that grabs the headlines. We want to focus on the North Carolinas. We want to focus on the Auburns, the Cam Newtons, because that's where and that drives the perception. But I would submit, and I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna, but I would submit that the perception is not what the reality is. And I would say that extends throughout most of sport. But that's not what grabs the headlines.
Well, it gets to a point, though, that I wanted to get to, and I'll keep it with you for a second, Bill, and that is, are things better or worse than they have been in years past? And I'm going to take this a step further, because there are some parts, frankly, of cheating or altering, you know, frankly, for as long as baseball has been played, people have been throwing spitballs and doctoring the ball. In some ways, they get celebrated. A lot of those guys ended up in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
It's against the rules, but still, you know, and by the definitions, at least, that all of you advanced, violates the integrity of the game, but we don't seem to get as upset about that as some other violations, and in fact celebrated. Has it gotten better or worse?
I believe it's gotten better. And I would say when I broke into sports writing, the culture was entirely different. You traveled with a team. You hung out with a coach. You had a couple of beers with a coach. I don't think the enforcement process was nearly what it was on the collegiate level then. And certainly in terms of performance-enhancing substances, I think we've come a long way. It's hard to keep up with the cheaters in some respects, but I think overall that the climate is better simply because there is much more attention paid to it now than in years gone by. Used to, the only thing we really cared about was on the scoreboard, and we didn't. If a kid showed up and he had $20 bills hanging out of his pockets, we really didn't much care. Show me what it says on the scoreboard. Now I think that there is truly taint that goes along with scandal, and we've had to shame people. Unfortunately, we've had to shame people into trying to do it the right way. So I would say I would overall submit that I think it's a better climate than it was. Always could be better.
I'm gonna go to Julie on that one first, because we're talking about collegiate. But I'll pick up Daniel Lee in a second, because I think with cycling there is some application. Has it gotten better or worse? Has your job gotten easier or harder in more recent years?
I think the overall commitment to integrity when you're looking at college sports has gotten better. And by that, Bill talked about a little bit, but in terms of the amount of resources that schools and now the association at the national office level dedicate to this whole notion of compliance and regulation, whether it's the amount of effort that goes into a rule getting on the books, or the amount of effort that goes into investigating a potential violation or threat to integrity, as you'd say, both in terms of what we do at the national office, but then also what schools do at the campus level. What I think has gotten worse is the emphasis on winning over integrity. And you've heard President Emmert probably talk about this notion of risk-reward. In many circles, it's seen that the reward of winning outweighs the risk of getting caught, whether that's either they're wondering if they will get caught, or if they do get caught, is the action really a deterrence? And that is something that President Emmert and other presidents are walking up to look at what is our entire violation and penalty structure, and does it make sense? Is there enough deterrence there in order to really persuade those who are starting to wonder and potentially cave into the temptation to hopefully step back and not cross that line.
And I guess the place I'd like to take this with Daniel Lee, because your book is really about sort of the evolution of cycling and how it's taken hold, competitive cycling in the United States. And I guess where I would go with that, you know, 40 years ago in this country, the folks who were interested or even knew what the Tour de France was pretty much just a subculture. Now, of course, it is a significant focus of interest in this country. Has our attention to the scandals, and we'll talk about the doping a little more in a few minutes, that seems to be the the story of the moment in cycling. But is that a product also of the rise, the fact that so much attention now is paid to sports, and it's become, frankly, such huge business? There is so much money flowing through that the rewards for cheating are massive.
Yes, without a doubt. In my book, I quote a guy named John Howard, who was really kind of one of the first really successful cyclists and was a multiple-time Olympian in the 1970s. And I asked him about doping, and he said, you know, really, at the U.S. national team at that time, we were just such green amateurs. We loved racing, and we weren't in that culture that maybe the Dutch or the Belgians were in, where they already had that culture of taking amphetamines or whatever it might be. And he's like, you know, we had our day and competed, and we didn't have the team doctors that introduced that culture. And he was happy for that. And, you know, he said almost a direct quote, he said the payoff for that is, you know, here I am in my 60s. I'm still enjoying the sport. And for me, cycling has always been about being out, enjoying the great weather, the blue sky. I agree with what Julie said about the overemphasis of winning, and certainly it's in the American culture to try to win. What's interesting is, like, in the French, and we love to make fun of the French here in this country, but that doesn't mean we can't learn some things from them. One of the most famous cyclists ever there is a guy named Raymond Poulidor, who had the nickname the Eternal Second. But he was a valiant fighter, happened to be up against much more talented riders like Eddy Merckx. Yet he never gave up. And this year's Tour de France, which I think is viewed as one of the cleanest in years, a guy named Tommy Vogler, a Frenchman, held the yellow jersey, the leader's jersey, for many days. And, you know, he fought beyond, you know, he pushed himself to the limit. And you could see his jersey zipped open and the grimace on his face, and just fighting with every ounce of his being to try to keep that jersey. And, you know, that to me creates better memories than maybe a bland winner. And Butler is the perfect example of that. You know, I'm sure the guys on the team are crushed by not winning those two championship games, but really they created one of the best sports memories in Indiana recent history. And, you know, it's much more interesting to me than some major conference team that maybe won one title along the way. And what they did is incredible. And they didn't win the end, but, you know, that didn't change the historic value of what they did.
And Bill Benner, you really want to get in on that.
Well, I just want to say, and sadly, lost to a team in the championship game that's now going on NCAA probation, University of Connecticut. So that's you got in that championship game, and it was cast as a morality play by the sporting press down in Houston. But you did have the one that really stood for everything that you hope intercollegiate athletics can be, and then you had the other that really represented big time intercollegiate athletics with the additional penalties that they were about to encounter for running afoul of the NCAA rules.
Are the penalties for cheating severe enough?
Well, I think we're moving toward that, and I'm all for it. Let's bring the hammer, whether it's a Belgian hammer or not, and let's bring it, and let's root the cheaters out of here. The other point I would like to make, though, John,
sure,
is as a society, we want our sportsmen and our sportswomen to value integrity. As a society, as the guys who are sitting in the stands, as the guys who are buying the season tickets, as the guys who are writing the checks to their booster club, are they as committed to integrity as we want our sportsmen and sportswomen to be? And I think that's a real interesting debate. John LaCrone, our commissioner, and I, we talk all the time about the big cigar guys. And the big cigar guys are the guys who write the checks and believe they have influence. And the big cigar guys aren't necessarily interested if you go 4-8 and not to a bowl game, but you do it the right way. I was talking to Bill Lynch, who just was let go as the Indiana University football coach. We were talking about cheating and rules violations. He says, don't talk to me. I tried to do things the right way, and I got fired.
Yeah.
So
we are talking about integrity in sports with our guests, Julie Rowe Lash of the NCAA, Bill Benner, a longtime sports writer, and author Daniel Lee. We'll be joined in just a few minutes by Mark Everson. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about integrity in sports. We would like to invite you to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Our guests today are Julie Rowe Lash, VP of Enforcement for the NCAA, Bill Benner, a longtime Indianapolis sports writer who's now with the Horizon League, Daniel Lee, author of the new book, The Belgian Hammer, and we've just been joined by Mark Everson, former IRS commissioner who oversaw the Balco steroid scandal. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. We'll talk a little bit about what it was like to be at the center of that storm.
Well, this was a very interesting case, and I think one of great consequence, because if you just think about the damage that was done, Marion Jones, there was no bigger icon in sports, period, or no bigger role model for girls or women or athletes of any type. She had to turn back her 5 gold medals, and she did prison time. Barry Bonds, who no bigger player in professional sports, he has been convicted for obstruction of justice and will probably do jail time. So this was a very bad indictment of just what was happening in sports at the highest levels and being accepted, I would tell you, by Major League Baseball in particular as a way of doing business.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit. About Bill, you were making that point really just a couple of minutes ago, Bill Benner, when you were saying, making reference to the big cigar guys, but the folks in the booster clubs and all of that, the celebration of winning at all costs or achieving at all costs, including breaking the rules. How did we get to that point? I mean, when, frankly, did it stop being a game? And I've noticed there are stunned looks. I'll go back to Bill Benner.
No, I'd say the money influence. The rewards are so great and so significant that you get distracted by the shiny object. You know, that's what you focus on, and you focus on winning and the gold medals and all the trappings that come with that, and you forget about, or you don't care about, integrity. That becomes secondary to the pursuit of winning.
Well, although I've got to say, at some level, I think it starts earlier than that. I mean, we've all had the experience of being at a Little League baseball
starts in the fifth grade when we're ranking America's top fifth grade basketball players. That's where it starts.
Well, and I've got to say, even then, one of my memories of being I can't remember who it was, elementary or junior high basketball player, was that at one point I read all of the sports books about integrity and all of that, and I think I remember John Wooden's the famous story about him calling timeout a player could have a little, on the opposing team could have a little extra recovery time. And I remember, you know, at one point, another player on the other team and I were going after the ball. It went out of bounds. I was the one who touched it last, but the ref called it out on the other guy, and I said, nope, I was the one who touched it last, at which point my coach gave me a quick ticket to the bench and pretty much ended my basketball career. But that was not a great loss to sport. There was no money. There was no glory there. Nobody was going to go on to anything. But there was this idea that you had to win regardless.
It runs annually. It runs much, much deeper than money. Professional cycling is not a highly paid sport at all. In fact, in America, even professional riders can make from basically zero up to maybe $80,000 on the local circuit. Over in Europe, they can make much more and into the millions for the very top. But yet, even with some of those guys not really having prospects of becoming millionaires from it, they're still cheating. And one of the things when I did my book, I chose to focus on kind of this new generation, and I put something in the front page of the book that said, you know, this book is inspired by the notion that the future is always with the young. And whenever I read a biography or memoir of someone, I always find the most interesting part kind of their pre-success. And I wanted to get a chance to look at some of these young athletes coming up, why their characters and their skills were still being formed, and who were the people that they were surrounded by. And those people come down to a tremendous influence, you know, and it helps. And because in the end, whether it's the big cigar guys or whatever temptations must come along, it comes down to a personal choice. And people can rationalize why they cheat or dope. And, you know, whether it's coming back from an injury, I'd be where I was if I hadn't gotten injured. In the end, it's a personal choice, and that's just the way it is. And, you know, it's something that athletes have to face.
Jim, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing great. I really appreciate your discussion today. It's kind of been a sore spot with me for a long time about the loss of sportsmanship, most notably at the high school level. That I agree with everything you said about it. It's not just the money. It's the American culture of win at any cost. And my comment was going to be, I've heard this the Mike and Mike show in the morning and heard Mike Golic talk about you have an obligation to your team to, when you know you've done what you just used an example of, went out of bounds and the referee didn't call it, you have an obligation to your team to try and sell the referee that, in fact, you didn't free, is what I question. He always talks about integrity on the show, but then he would support the idea that you should sell the referee on something that didn't happen if it benefits your team. And I just feel like I have kids playing soccer, and, you know, soccer player parents are the worst about, there's no sportsmanship. Sportsmanship is whatever it takes for your team to win. It's no longer about teaching the values of sportsmanship and integrity and all those sort of things. It's even down to the high school level where there is no money. So it's not about the money. It's about the culture of winning at all costs. You must win at all costs. And I know Bill had a high school swimmer, and you know, you don't quite see that in swimming as much. But I know, having had a high school athlete, I just wondered if he would comment on that it is the culture now, not just the money.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Best thing about swimming was, as I always told my daughter, and her coach always told her, the clock never lies. But that, again, that's not to say that there aren't some swimmers who would use artificial substances to enhance their performance.
I remember years ago being in Ireland on a trip, and we were in Galway, where Michelle Smith was from, and someone had gone way out into the bay, huge rock, and spray painted the words "Michelle is innocent." And I think this gets to Mark's point here when they found out that she was not, in fact, innocent there, it had a devastating impact. We talk a little bit about what it does to, you know, the folks who follow sports, particularly the kids. Mark Everson.
Well, the point I'd like to make on top of the integrity is these substances are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And President Bush made that point. He actually stuck it in a State of the Union address back in 2004 because steroids are dangerous substances. We're talking now about the NFL, about concussions and the long-term impact on players of concussions. No doubt the steroids have been proven to have a very detrimental impact on health. So now you've got kids who want to play big-time football in college, and they're using steroids. And they're doing that because they saw Barry Bonds and others get to be a big deal. Barry Bonds' hat size grew because of the use of steroids. And this, it's not just about integrity, although I agree with the core of the message here. There's also a physical risk because of the ingestion of these substances.
Daniel Lee.
Actually, the biggest point I would like to make about doping, and there's certainly physical risks, but to me, it's actually a mental health issue. And early, when I was reporting the book, I was interviewing a young pro rider named Daniel Holloway, asked him about doping, and he said, you can get more money and results. He's like, but at the end of the day, he's like, you look at Floyd Landis. And this was in the news at the time, with Floyd had just confessed. And in an interview, Floyd had talked about he couldn't look at his mom in the eye when they were talking. And he's like, I couldn't imagine carrying that on my shoulders. And he's like, you know, my dad instilled in me to do things the right way. And if anyone saw Tyler Hamilton on 60 Minutes, I mean, he's a tortured person, you know, and he said, looking at my Olympic gold medal made me sad. That's what he, you know. And I interviewed a doctor in my book, a former team doctor, And she talked about after people get caught by U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, get suspended, I mean, depression, clinical depression, you know, many of these suffer from. And think about some of the very famous athletes in baseball or whatever, how they're going to look back on their careers, you know, all the work they put in. Are they going to feel, I mean, you always have to live with yourself. And if that's one thing I could get across to young athletes, you know, I mean, at the end of things, you have to live with yourself and you know what you did or didn't do. And to me, that's just about the greatest deterrent because, you know, those are just horrible burdens to carry around.
Well, and I'd like to talk, I mean, we're focusing on the athletes right now, and that's appropriate, but I think we have left that point that Bill was making. By the way, Bill, I think you've introduced the term big cigar boys into the lexicon now. That's one that a lot of people are going to use. And really the complicity, because when we talk about this, I mean, I've got a friend who's a former world-ranked competitive cyclist, and he said everybody knew the guys who were doping. But there was this sort of conspiracy of silence. Obviously, when Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa were chasing down Roger Maris's record, almost everyone knew about that, too. It would be whispered about, but no one would talk about it all that directly. Why?
Well,
Bill Benner.
I would let Mark address this.
Yeah.
But I would say baseball may have made an institutional decision post losing a year for the strike when they lost the World Series to look the other way to drive the popularity of the sport with the home run derby that subsequently ensued.
Well, and it did. The rewards were immense. I mean, it did kind of save the game. But Mark, yeah, please.
Baseball was an outlier here. When we did the investigation, we got good cooperation from the NFL, the NBA. Baseball took every opportunity to drag their feet. And it reflected the economic interests, as just was stated, and Selig and the owners didn't want this problem to be confronted. And it took our action, it took the congressional inquiries, and the point that it was going to get very serious indeed before they sort of lined up.
When they dragged their feet, how did they do that?
Well, we asked for materials. They had drug testing records. They had their own programs, and they had their own test results. And we would go and request them, and then it took an inordinate amount of time to get the materials that we had requested in a legitimate law enforcement investigation. That was not the case with the other leaks. And that can only be interpreted in one way if you're sitting in the chair that I was sitting in.
Is that part of was part of the problem there that it was the players, you know, the worst case scenario for them seemed to be, okay, the players may get thrown under the bus here, but we're going to be okay. Do you need some mechanisms for owners and or because they obviously they benefit from this as well?
Well, I think they felt they were acting in their own self-interest. And the degree to which a school or you got the same thing at the college levels, who knew what about what was happening when? And clearly, when you get to the professional leagues, they had certain things, testing results, and that would indicate potential problems. And if they didn't act on it, or the information would have given every reason to believe that the policy should have been revised to be more rigorous, and yet they weren't taking those actions, well, that could be damning information if it became public. And that was the fear, that it would become public through our investigations.
Do you think the use of drugs or chemical enhancements in sports has peaked, or is it going to get worse?
Hard for me to know. I mean, I haven't been at the service in over 4 years, but I do think that, like any intervention through law enforcement, that people do respond seriously to this. We talked to the Mitchell investigating group. I talked to the senator myself when they started their work, and I do think that that's had a big impact in recent years on the sport and on other sports. And then the Clemens matter was not that was not the IRS matter. That was a question of lying to Congress. But each of these things has an impact, and something we didn't get into. All the IRS matters, the Balco stuff, not for Conde, but for the athletes, was all about lying to the IRS when people were asked, did you take the drugs? If people had answered honestly, they wouldn't have been in peril, legal peril. they might have lost their medals
or their endorsement contracts or whatever.
Or their records may have been nullified, but they wouldn't have gotten into legal trouble. What would have happened is they might have been compelled to testify in the criminal trial of Victor Conti or others who were supplying the drugs, but they didn't do that. They obstructed justice or lied. And then it got drawn out, and then they lost the medals anyway.
Boy, it sounds almost as if that's yet another product of this win or succeeded any cost culture here, and that they think the endorsement deals or whatever are more important than avoiding prison. In that case, that they would rather risk prison than economic loss or some embarrassment. You're listening to No Limits, and we are talking about integrity in sports. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a tweet from a listener who says, "Where's the balance in the risk-reward formula of doping in cycling? It seems the penalties aren't deterrent enough yet." Daniel Lee, I think that one's pitched toward you, although I would take it to all sports. Daniel Lee.
Well, if properly enforced, I think it's a pretty good deterrent. I mean, generally a two-year ban in big-time cycling, it hasn't always been enforced evenly, and there's been seemingly loopholes that have come up. But 2 years is a pretty substantial penalty. I believe that there was belief that people could get away with it. I think that's slowly changing. And the sport is very fragmented. It doesn't have one central kind of governing body like the NFL that kind of sees over everything. So there tends to be a lot of fighting, which I think has allowed some of the cheating to go on between the different groups. But I believe a two-year ban. There are some who call for a lifetime ban. I don't know where you draw the line on that. On some level, I believe in forgiveness, and particularly when people confess. And there are some riders who have come back from doping bans who are great ambassadors for anti-doping. And so that's nice to have people being able to reinvent themselves. I don't think it's the ban. I think it's consistent enforcement and creating cultures within the teams that minimize the temptation to dope.
Julie Rolash, your situation's a little different because obviously the NCAA, in addition to being a major, creating major sporting events, is supposed to have an educational component to it as well, so that in theory you're supposed to be teaching the student athletes to learn from their mistakes as well. Are there deterrents enough in place to prevent cheating, or are there things you'd like to see changed?
Well, I think that precise question is what the President Emmert is hosting a retreat next week, and about 50 college presidents are going to be converging on Indianapolis to talk about what President Emmert has identified as three key issues, and one of those is integrity. And when we talk about integrity, we talk about this whole notion of risk-reward, and have the rewards become so great that they've really dwarfed the risk. So when you're talking about, are the penalties effective? Is there really a sense of getting caught? What we hear from many coaches is no. No, we're not. The risk of getting caught is so low, and the penalties are not a strong enough deterrent. When you think about the National Office deals with violations that involve both student athletes, and I think when I talked to Bill 10 years ago, that was the group that I worked in. That group really thinks about both what's the appropriate penalty to not only address the situation and try to equalize the playing field, but also have some sort of punitive effect without taking away the student athlete's entire career. It's a very different take when the Committee on Infractions has a major infractions case before it, and that's when a coach finds him or herself in the midst of a rules violation or one of the cases you read in the headlines. That Committee on Infractions will look at not just a coach as a coach or a student athlete, but more importantly, as an educator. So when a coach crosses the line, what sort of message is that coach failing to send to the student athletes on his or her team?
We are talking about integrity in sports here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Our guests are Julie Rolash, the NCAA, Bill Benner, longtime sports writer, Daniel Lee, author of The Belgian Hammer, and Mark Everson, former IRS commissioner. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about integrity in sports with our guests, Julie Rolash, VP of Enforcement for the NCAA, Bill Benner, longtime Indianapolis sports writer, now with the Horizon League, Daniel Lee, who is the author of the new book, The Belgian Hammer, about American cyclists in Europe, and Mark Everson, the former IRS commissioner who oversaw the Balco steroid scandal. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've got a question here, and I hope I'm going to pronounce the name right, from Martin D'Agostino, I think, that was picking up on Julie Rolash's conversation or points a moment ago. So shouldn't we at least discuss whether big-time college sports are consistent with university mission? Julie, I think that one probably will start with you, but anyone who feels compelled to join in can do so.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a fair question, and one that gets asked especially most recently quite a bit, not just by fans, but you've heard conference commissioners raise the question about the big-time sports, so to speak. And I don't think that the questions are raised more with a sense of, yes, let's have some sort of split, but more of what sort of behaviors are happening right now, either by student-athletes, coaches, programs, boosters, or as Bill would call them, the big cigar guys. I'd also introduce into that, though, equation agents, which that's a pretty broad umbrella. We work with a lot of agents. I know a lot of agents, but there are also some agents who don't have the interests of the school, the program, or the student-athlete at heart, but are clearly trying to exploit the student-athlete to make money. And all of those forces do really elevate that student-athlete in these elite sports to a different place than the rest of the student population. So I think that's really what's driving the question. What I think the point is looking at, okay, what's happening that does somehow create all of this pressure on these elite student-athletes and, frankly, as we're talking about here, their coaches to win, and what can we do about trying to restore and reinforce integrity, not just for those sports, but for all of the sports, but especially with these elite student-athletes who are facing these pressures that are different than some pressures that other student-athletes face. I don't think the answer is to call it a semi-professional league or semi-pro sports and just completely draw a line and separate, because I think that would really lose out on the idea and, in fact, the fact that these student-athletes, many of them, are getting a good quality education. And what we see is, I wish I had the stats memorized, I don't right now, but the number of student-athletes, both in these elite sports, men's basketball and football, who progress towards a degree are much higher in those sports than the rest of the student population. So you have a better chance of graduating, bottom line, if you're a student-athlete than if you're just a student. And I think if you start to just take away the educational opportunity that's provided to a lot of these student-athletes, you're really taking away a vital plan B, if you will, for those that aren't going to make it to the professional ranks.
Well, and I guess where I would take the argument you hear on the other side here is that there, particularly with, you know, college basketball, college football, there are just massive amounts of money flowing through there. And everybody seems to be getting a piece of it but the athletes, the people who are putting their bodies on the line.
I disagree.
You disagree?
Absolutely. Stronger. College education.
Well, admittedly. Hello. Well, admittedly, but with the size of the budgets flowing through there, I mean, what, the most expensive school in the country is Harvard, and that's, what, over 4 years, about $250,000?
John, I wrote the checks for two college educations. I know what they cost, and I know I'm speaking for hundreds of listeners out there who know the cost. I think Mark wanted to say something.
Yeah, Mark Everson, please.
I do think this is a legitimate public policy question, because these are tax-exempt institutions, and they are operating like businesses in this regard, and that just needs to be considered, because you end up with the coaches being paid in the millions of dollars just as if they were coaching professional teams. It's no longer part of an educational. People can give money to these programs, and it's deducted from their taxes. And is that good public policy? I don't disagree that there are benefits for individuals, but you basically have you could argue it's just the minor leagues for certain sports is what it's really
become. Well, and I want to get back to that, and I want to make clear, I'm not advocating a position here. I'm trying to toss out the other side of the argument.
Nor am I.
But I guess what you're saying here is you're right. It's a charitable contribution. Most of these institutions are 501c3s, so that means that the gifts you make to them are tax deductible. And yet you've got coaches who sign these major endorsement deals that require the athletes to use certain kinds of equipment and all of that sort of stuff. There does seem to be some intersection between commerce and education here that ought to be looked at a little bit. Bill Benner.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I am a member of the Indiana University Varsity Club, so just so you know.
Does that mean you are a big cigar guy?
I'm not a big cigar guy.
All right.
I'm a Tipperillo guy. Okay. But the perspective I would like to place, as we talk about big time, men's basketball, football, but that is such a... You need to place that in a perspective. And the perspective is, and Julie, we know this, the 400,000 student athletes. How many member institutions in the NCAA?
Around 1,100.
1,100. And only a tiny fraction of those are engaged in the kind of activities that draw the attention, draw the money, have all the money forces. You know, and again, I know I'm being a Pollyanna here. I sat around the table last week. We had our student athlete advisory committee from the Horizon League. Two athletes, student athletes from every school in the conference. And they come in. What do you do? Well, I have a 3.98 in civil engineering, and I volunteer for Special Olympics on the weekend. And they're these wonderful examples. And going back to my point at the start of the show, there are far more examples of those kinds of student athletes who value the free college education that they are getting or the partially supported college education that they're getting, and they relish that opportunity. But we do tend to focus on the Big Tens and the SECs, and it's almost two different worlds there.
But many of the
Julie Rolash, yeah, please.
Thank you. Many of the conferences, like the Big Ten and the SEC, they also, and I know you weren't saying this, Bill, but they also have the stellar examples,
yes,
like you just described,
yes,
of the true student athlete, and even in the elite high profile,
yes,
sports. And that those examples are often lost, even though that I think those student athletes make up the clear majority of intercollegiate student-athletes. They truly are balancing academics and athletics. The other just perspective piece, because I think a lot of people, it's easy to say there are millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars flowing through. With the NCAA, 96 cents of every dollar goes right back to the member schools. And then, as Bill said, you're talking about revenue and non-revenue sports. When you look at the data that's published annually, very few athletics programs run in the black. In fact, most run in a deficit. And a lot of that is because it's very expensive to give scholarships to student athletes, to give them facilities. It's not just the scholarship, I'd argue, Bill, and I know you weren't limiting it there, but you think about the state-of-the-art facilities and coaching that a lot of student athletes have the benefit of. I played Division III, and I had a better experience there than I think I could have had anywhere. I mean, I don't think I could have played at a higher level, but the coaching experience, the athletic training, all of those intangible benefits, I suppose you could put a dollar value on them, but that's the type, to me, the additional value of a scholarship or experience, if you will, that's often lost when we talk about, do we need to give more to our student athletes? Having said that, I will tell you, on the table for discussion, and many conference commissioners and presidents have raised this issue, is it appropriate to try to fund and give student athletes above the value of a full grant and aid? So we're talking more than just the tuition, room and board and books, but also that federal dollar, the cost of attendance, making up the difference between a cost of attendance and the full grant and aid. USA Today just today had a nice rundown of what that would actually translate into in terms of dollars for every Division I institution. And for some, it would be a pretty sizable increase in budget, and others not so much. But that is at least one proposal on the table. It's not actually a full proposal, but one idea that the membership is discussing currently.
We've gotten some questions also. I'm going to try to consolidate and synthesize them here. They're, for lack of a better term, moral turpitude questions, or, you know, if that don't necessarily relate to the game, but probably the best example is a tweet we got from a listener named Ben, who says, what does the panel think of the off-field antics, a la, you know, Pat McAfee. does having fun send the wrong signals? Obviously, we've had that, you know, episodes here in the city where professional athletes have been caught drunk driving and doing other things that that they probably shouldn't have. Does that fall into the category? I mean, I know Charles Barkley famously did that commercial where he said, "I am not a role model." But there is that kind of expectation. Daniel Lee.
Well, actually, cycling certainly has some, you know, mischievous behavior or poor behavior, but actually not that much because I think that the athletes are so tired. I mean, when the Tour de France, you basically just want to go get your massage and go to sleep as soon as the race is over because it's so grueling. So, you know, I don't know that, that cycling has that kind of culture. Guys are occasionally caught, you know, drinking, you know, reckless driving or things like that. But it's really not something that, that's, you know, grabs headline in the sport. But it certainly goes back to integrity, and you are, you know, a role model and a representative for your team. And I know I talked with some of the coaches coaching young athletes that, that talk about that. And in cycling, it's you're representing your sponsor. And if there's certain behavior, you're going to jeopardize the funding of your team because these teams are sponsored by businesses and corporations that don't want to be associated with, you know, unsavory behavior.
Bill Benner, should athletes be role models?
Well, to whom much is given, much is expected, and I think that's something that we all should live by. By the same, at the same time, athletes are humans, and we all make mistakes. And when they do it, it's when Pat McAfee goes for a late night swim in the Broad River Canal. It's going to be in the paper next day. And if somebody else had done it, which I'm sure it's been done, it doesn't make the headlines. So, and I taught at Butler for 10 years in sports journalism. I had a number of student athletes, and I always said that, son, if you screw up, everybody will know it. If you're the youngster sitting next to you who's not a student athlete screws up, nobody will know it. And so there is that higher standard that you have to abide by. And by the way, Pat McAfee, I thought, did a wonderful job of mea culpa and trying to rehabilitate his image and trying to emphasize that that was a huge mistake that he made. But he was, I think he expressed sincere, a very sincere apology.
Well, and I want to take this back to sort of where we started. I think there's a consensus that actually there's more focus now on integrity in sports, that to some degree, at the very least, we now have a much better idea of what the scope of the challenges are in regard there. What are, since we're getting close to the end of the program, what are a few concrete steps we could take to further support the idea of integrity in sports? Julie Rolash, I'll start with you.
Well, I think you're right. First is to agree there's a focus, and second is to say what are the threats? What are the concrete threats, and then what are some things we can do about them? So when we've talked on the college sports and on that level, we've talked about the risk-reward threat. The other key threats that we're talking about currently within the NCAA relates to our rules. Are there too many that are either insignificant, they were adopted for the wrong reason, and it's tough to achieve real reform? And another threat deals with the external influence. I talked a little bit about the agents, but it's really the third party. So it's getting a handle on what are the real threats, and then more importantly, what do you do about them? So does that mean you've got to overhaul the violation or the penalty structure? Does that mean you want to try to assert more jurisdiction over agents, which we don't have, but that means we work more with the professional leagues and with the state agencies who have the ability to prosecute violators? Does that mean we revamp the rules or take a look at how rules are adopted? Possibly. But that's really the, I think it's first you've got to show a commitment, as you said, commitment to the focus, identify what the threats are, and then start to think about some solutions.
Daniel Lee, a couple of concrete steps.
Yes, I think that fans, athletes, coaches all hold a good amount of power. I'm donating a small portion of my proceeds of my book to a group called Bike Pure, which is kind of an international grassroots. They call themselves an anti-doping brand, and they do some level of kind of lobbying for clean cycling. It was founded by some cycling riders, as well as fans. There's some of the Tour de France riders wear these blue Bike Pure bands during the race. You know, one of the most popular U.S. teams, Garmin Transitions, is very known for being stringently anti-doping, have their own internal controls, plus what they face from the governing bodies. They're the most popular team, even among the other top American teams, even when before this year they weren't winning as many. And I think fans have gotten so sick of these scandals that they've glommed on to that. And I think if you can create that kind of a reverse boycott, that kind of fan pressure, that's something that people can do. You know, that to me is a positive step from the teams themselves. I mean, I think surrounding yourselves with coaches of integrity, mentors, that's invaluable too.
To use Bill Benner's point, getting the big cigar boys to get behind integrity real quickly. We've got about 30 seconds. Mark Everson.
Just the money's had a corrosive effect here, and it does take the leaders of the professional leagues, and then, as Julie was saying, it's going to take the university presidents to sit back and say, is this where we want to go and how we want to educate our young?
Bill Benner, the good news is you've got the last word. The bad news is you've got about 10 seconds to deliver it.
Take ownership, incentivize good behavior, and penalize poor behavior.
I want to thank all of you for joining us. This has been a very lively hour, and I've learned from each one of you. And I also would like to thank our listeners for joining us and for sending in questions, calling in questions. We have been talking about integrity in sports. We have been fortunate to have as our guests Julie Rowe Lash, who is the VP of Enforcement for the NCAA. Julie, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Daniel Lee, who is the author of the brand new book, The Belgian Hammer. Daniel, good talking with you.
Thanks so much.
Mark Everson, who is former IRS commissioner who oversaw the Balco steroid scandal. Mark, thank you for making time to be
thank
with
you.
Us. And Bill Benner, longtime Indianapolis sports writer who is now with the Horizon League. Bill, it's a pleasure sitting down with you again.
Same here, John. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We will be back next week. Please join us. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Have a good week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Matthew Sosi. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.